This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Safe home bases.
Aggressor and Krasnovia.
1950s fantasy film essentials.
And the Hammersmith ghost murder case.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin! The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive, the faux wood paneling, the pool table in the back corner, the washer and the dryer, the shag carpeting, that old ratty couch. It makes a safe home for the gaming hut. And today, as we nestle into that safe home with our dice, chips, miniatures, Peter Frampton, etc., we... think, we recall to ourselves, we ponder, perhaps, the importance of a safe home, not just for the players, but for the player characters. Robin, this is a law of drama that at least in television goes back to the old have gun, will travel, where regardless of what happened to Paladin, he always made it back to the Drake Hotel in San Francisco, and everything was fine again. There are canonical home bases that are less safe. They get invaded all the damn time, like the good old USS Enterprise. So I suppose the question is, in which genres or types of game do you want to privilege safety for the home base? And in which ones is it kind of okay to have the home base constantly under threat by space amoebas and Jack the Ripper and whatnot, correct?
Right. So first of all, zooming out to a more structural level, the point of having a safe home base for the player characters is part of campaign play. Mm-hmm. You might have, in the middle of a horror game, everybody go back to the coffee shop and, you know, develop their wits and talk their way through their problems and so forth. But chances are this is a campaign. And so classically, I think F20 games envision this not so much as a headquarters per se, although... because often in a fantasy game, you sort of hand wave where you hang out, right? You're in an inn,
yeah.
But there's a whole town.
Or you're itinerant, and so you don't actually have a given home. You're just at the inn in the next dungeon town over, right?
Right. And even when you're, you know, at a dungeon, you sort of camp outside the dungeon. Although, as we'll get to, that camp can be invaded in the night. That is something that the players tend not to like, because their whole point of going out to the camp is to refresh all of their stuff. And it sort of messes with the premise of the game, which is you're supposed to be able to retreat out of the super dangerous area into the less dangerous area, rest up, get ready, go back. And so there's an implicit safety even in your camp outside the dungeon, and there's an implicit town that you can go to, or series of towns that are all essentially the same, where you can always buy new armor and trade in your different potions for other potions. And sometimes, again, that will come under threat, but that doesn't happen so often in F20, does it?
No.
Horror, if it has a horror adventure idea, Miskatonic University, of course, is our, you know, big example in the Lovecraftian horror genre of a relatively safe place where you're going to go. Sure, there's a break-in at the library ever so often where the dogs rip a half-human hybrid to shreds, but that's the system working, right?
Right, yeah.
So there's a safe place you can go. There's people you can talk to, presumably the comfort of your dorm or a common room. So that's a place both where you can rest up after one spate of danger, and then, get told where the next danger is and go. And so that gives you a home base. And like a lot of home bases, that reinforces something about the premise of your campaign. So if your safe base is Miskatonic University, that assumes you're academics, or some of you are, or you're university adjacent at any rate, and that there might be other people there, a core of folks who are helping you. And so that tells you all sorts of things about the game. So it's not just the sense of respite that people like, the idea that they have a home base, but the thematic underpinnings of that. And that's where your television analogy comes in, because usually TV shows will have a few standing sets that are the implicit headquarters of the place. So, you know, Star Labs and Jitters in the Arrowverse Flash show, for example. And these, again, tell you about the different sides of the show, the different ways that people interact in those environments, but also creates a sense of comfort that exists in the case of TV for the audience to be able to relax a bit, and therefore create that wave of hope and fear that is essential to any narrative. And, you need a little bit of downtime to then worry about the Flash and the gang again afterwards.
Yeah. The question, basically, I think we alluded to it earlier, is the campaign such, even in a campaign where we are being punctuated by rests, is the campaign intentionally globetrotting or itinerant or picaresque or whatever word that you want to mean, such that there's no point in developing any given safe house in Night's Black Agents, because 3 days from now you're going to be in Oslo fighting vampires from a different safe house. And so the part of the point of it is the sort of anonymity with a telling detail that you establish the fact of travel, and taking that same approach in an F20 game, you know, maybe it's not always just the generic inn. Maybe each inn is subtly different depending on what part of the realm you're in, or what, you know, side of the mountains you're on, or whatever. And so you can still have the feeling of something safe, because these inns are basically built to a relatively standard pattern, but you can always throw in something different and interesting to provide a hook for downtime play. You know, oh, this inn has a darts board. Who's good at darts in the group? Besides the thief, no one trusts the thief. But besides him, who's good at darts? And then we can have, you know, the role-playing happen around a place in the respite. And that can provide some of the characterization that I think you're correct to point out Star Labs and Jitters provide in The Flash, and the Enterprise provided in Star Trek and everything else, of the party as a whole, or the Miskatonic would provide, without necessarily making the player characters redescribe the whole thing every time, and thus lose the fun of a adventuresome, fast-moving setting that is always in a different, like, terrible, weird hotel, like in Supernatural. The hotels are always, you know, deeply messed up in some decor fashion, but they're very seldom attacked in their motel room, and so that's still functionally a safe place, right?
Yeah, so I was thinking of that as the sort of equivalent of your F20. They go to a different town every week, and the inns are all slightly different. So that's exactly what is happening in Supernatural, and that's its function. And so the point is physical rest, recharging your points and everything, and B, emotional rest and being able to have the characters chill out or talk about their plans, or, you know, just a sense that the players don't feel under constant pressure all of the time. There's also the question of how much like home does it feel? So, for example, I would think that even though it happens all the time in Star Trek, it's a stock element that people, even in as a Federation crew, are going to react much more negatively to having their ship invaded constantly than the fictional characters in the various TV shows, because they have a sense of home and rest around the Enterprise. And as we know, Ken, there are a number of things that are genre staples that players still hate.
Yes.
And so just like, you know, being imprisoned briefly to learn more information after you bust out is, you know, a stock element. We have to work really hard to make players accept that at the gaming table. And you might want to think twice about, so when you would normally have the chunk of the adventure where you're going out and getting in danger, if you let everybody have all the emotional and physical rest, then have the adventure take place in the home base, a bottle episode, if you were,
right,
I think people will feel somewhat less irked. But just like having, you know, someone's animal companion eaten by a hippogriff, you have to think carefully about violating their home base, and especially super carefully about destroying it entirely. You may think it's time to up the stakes and put all pressure on them all the time. And, oh, wait, you just said I'm going to put pressure on them all the time. Do the players want that?
Mm-hmm. And more to the point, can the campaign sustain it? Let's say that you destroy the Enterprise or their castle in a less itinerant F-20 game. Then what? How much of the game do you want to be about getting a new starship or castle? And if it's just as easy as going down to Castle Zar-Us and having the wizard womp up a new one, does that add any real danger or stakes to the next time that the castle's attacked by giants or whatever? So you put yourself in a situation where you think something's going to raise the stakes, but the fact that you have to come back next week means that the stakes either have to get weirdly cheapened, or you have to spend a lot of time grubbing in the mud for pieces of stone that you can slowly pile up to be your castle. And again, as you say, no one wants to do that. And even if you say we montage a year later and the castle has been rebuilt, you functionally just had a wizard whomp up, you know, insta-castle in terms of the felt experience of play. So, you know, blowing up the home base is a climax and should stay a climax, I think.
Yeah, it's either devastating or meaningless.
Right, yeah.
With nothing in between, mm-hmm. And you don't want either of those things. So the idea that, you know, the sanctity of the... And also, players, even more so than their fictional counterpart, want their characters to be free from the prying eyes of the antagonist for a while. They also want, you know, a cone of silence, to speak of another home base in another show. And that's something else that they, I think, quite rightly get mad about if they take all sorts of security precautions and then still, you know, the hippogriff comes busting through the wall and, you know, leaves a magical orb of scrying that you can't get rid of. That's just as annoying and ruins a big chunk of why people want a place to hide out. So I think our general conclusion here is if a game has a home base and that's part of your premise, treat it with the same respect and sanctity that you would somebody's pet dog or parrot. You've got to let it be part of the thing and it's part of the contract, and you mess with parrots or starships or castles at your peril.
That said, if they, you know, say, well, we'll beam the alien statue aboard, what could go wrong? Or we'll take this stone beholder back to our headquarters, what could go wrong? Well, I think that at this point, they have, even maybe just in their hearts, admitted that something can go wrong. And then you can have the fun rampage adventure. But, you know, rampage is not destroy, ideally, is what I'll say about
and
that.
If you can make them say, well, this is on us,
yeah,
that's great.
Yes.
Go to town. But if they feel that you, the GM, are putting the screws to a thing that they took as being, you know, part of the contract of the campaign, you're probably going to have a revolt at the table. Well, speaking of sanctity of safe spaces, we have the gaming hut, but I think it's time for us to leave the gaming hut and enter, by way of this exciting commercial, an even more fortified hut. 1968.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozukepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase.
The maps on the wall, the sand table in the middle of the room, the camouflage everyone is wearing, and the array of medals on the visiting officer tell us that we're once more standing in the command hut. And this time around, we're going to talk about enemies of the United States in the post-war era that perhaps you have forgotten, dear listener, because these enemies have been at a war with America for a long time in different guises. The one we're going to talk about most, from 1946 to 1978, of course, I'm talking about aggressor. And you're wondering, aggressor, what's that? Of course, this is the maneuver enemy for U.S. military training exercises. If you're going to do a training exercise where you're pretending to be at war, you have to pretend to be at war with some other force, some other country. And just as comic books make up places like Latveria, the U.S. military, in a manner, as we're about to discover, that seems eerily familiar, first of all, made up aggressor and later some successors to aggressor. So Ken, and this is a document that anybody can dial up themselves on the internet. It's in Wikimedia. It's called FM 30-102 Handbook on Aggressor Military Forces. You can download it in the beautiful PDF with all of the original 1946 beautiful graphic design, just begging to be used as inspiration for a role-playing supplement. And it's quite a thing. Sadly, though, the extensive backstory, the kind of familiar-seeming extensive backstory, is sadly uncredited.
Yes. We don't know what brilliant game designer was brought in to punch up the aggressor history, but they enjoyed their work, you could tell. And this is taking what many, many pages of data dump, none of it necessary to fight a pretend war, by the way. This is just some, you know, junior lieutenant enjoying themselves. But
this is just like a role-playing sub. I was going to get to this metaphor earlier, but it's too obvious. Yeah. It's just like a role-playing supplement because it starts with the 4 pages of useless, irrelevant backstory.
Right. So anyway, in this backstory, after World War II, as Europe lay in ruins and America foolishly withdrew its troops, a new authoritarian party, the Circle Trigon Party, or Circle Trigonists, led by Martin Bormann, of all people, a canon NPC in Aggressor, overthrows the weakened Spanish government. I'm not sure why Spain is trading their lovely homegrown fascist for a different fascist, but whatever. With the aid of secret police chief Pilar Cordoba, and then the Circle Trigon spreads subversion through southern France, northern Italy, Bavaria, and the Tyrol in Austria. These provinces, inspired by the demagogue Tito Ferrucci, Bavaria, of course, under the control of financier Kurt Friesen, rebel. The weakened European states can't do anything about it. Forces in the West amongst the Allies think, well, at least they'll be anti-communist and don't stop them. And they join in what is named the Aggressor Republic. And they name themselves Aggressor because they know that they have to be aggressive to solve the problems of their new country. And they bring all their militaries online. Full employment is their goal. Lots of industrialization. They make Esperanto their official language, which is, and even the military field manual says they tried to have Spanish as the language, but that wasn't good. So they changed it to Esperanto, or which is called Aggressor, by the way, in Aggressor. Their emblem, the Circle Trigon Party, is a cool green triangle in a white circle, sometimes with a green band around it. Their flag is a green triangle on a white field, or sometimes the green triangle on white on green, depending on exactly when it gets deployed. And
depends on whether they're playing home or away.
Right. Or naval amphibious forces or land forces, I guess. They use anti-communism to recruit the masses of Western Europe, but they are secretly funded and aided, Robin, and this is in the backstory, by the Comintern, by the Soviets, to weaken Europe and America. So very exciting. They're both fascists and commies. You couldn't ask for a better foe.
I feel like in the writer's room, someone pointed out that, hey, you've created a fascist threat.
Yes, we already did that one.
That's not acceptable at 1946. So to give people a flavor of the writing style, here's a little snippet. Aggressor was engaged in a race against time. She must be a well-established power when the dull and war-weary former allies realized her true ambition and organized to put her down. Her leaders believed that she must strike before that day. So, again, familiar role-playing seeming language.
Yep.
And the theme running through all of this backstory is how stupid people are to want to demobilize and not be at war anymore, and how that makes you weak and dull and ripe for being attacked by aggressor.
Right. Yes. If you're going to reduce military budgets, this is what's going to happen to you, says the military document. So anyway, the loads of European refugees and displaced persons go to the Caribbean. But amongst those people, Robin, are aggressor cadres. They rise up and seize the Panama Canal, take over Cuba and the Antilles, just in time for the aggressor navy to go through the Panama Canal and launch a surprise invasion of California. And if you're saying, aren't they in Europe? That would be a surprise. They invade California in 1946. The attempt is to rapidly seize California, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, and then trade those states for American recognition and alliance with aggressor. But of course, America won't stand idly by, even though, as the document points out, we are vulnerable to such invasion thanks to hasty and ill-advised demobilization.
There's that theme again.
The worst kind of demobilization. So they invade California in 1946. They're stymied there. Their second wave invades the St. Lawrence Seaway. You'll be glad to know, Robin, Canada, also a victim of aggressor.
Nice to be included.
And then the Southeast, they land in Florida in 47, which I guess makes sense because it already said Circle Trigon sympathizers in the government let them keep the Caribbean after the California War. And then after those two invasions, they left numerous subversive stay-behind units. There's lots of discussion that various units escaped after the war games and are hiding out somewhere amongst the population, and that's so that the army can start practice fighting insurgencies. Aggressor hits the Carolinas and Fort Bragg in 1948, and then they get the A-bomb in 1951, which in theory would have changed the nature of the war games pretty substantially, but I assume we were now doing aggressor proxy wars and whatnot for the next 30 years.
Right.
That second lieutenant was promoted to a real job, I think, and didn't go back to finish the backstory. So the timeline of aggressor, the official timeline, stops in 1951.
And that would be a later source book or handbook than the one I was looking at, because I was looking at the 46 one. So the document, again, it's 214 pages. It's got an overall org chart diagram and then one for each of the major military branches. It's got a territorial map. It's got a division structure and symbol format that old school wargamers will recognize. It's got a guns chapter, which includes the calibers and maximum effective ranges for weapons going all the way from the 75 millimeter guns, which are 13,850 yards effective range, to the infantry pistol, which is a 50 yards range. And the appendix lists pages and pages of military terms with translations in four languages. So again, prefiguring our industry, someone bulked up the page count with a useless appendix.
Yeah, 3102, that field manual is updated at least through 1966. 3101, aggressor, the maneuver enemy, is the sort of the backstory one. That's updated through 1961. 1959 is available on the internet if you're looking around for that one. So the whole aggressor, you know, core book package can be gotten. You can play just as accurately as we played in 1959 and 60, if we want.
Right. And I guess people read the backstory so that they could shout out in-character things while maneuvering, like, screw you, Tito Ferrucci.
Right, yes. Or so that the people playing Aggressor could be inspired to do their propaganda and whatnot, because, of course, Aggressor would fights a psychological war as well as a regular guerrilla war.
Right. I bet there's a lot of competition to play Pilar Cordoba.
I assume that that's the visiting general gets to play Pilar Cordoba all the time. The elite units in Aggressor's military, the same as the shock guards in Soviet military, are called the Fusiliers, which is great. The Aggressor uniforms are in dark jungle green instead of olive drab. Aggressor military equipment, because it's from Western Europe, is often very similar to American military equipment. As the exercises moved on, we got more and more Soviet bloc military equipment, which began to filter in to Aggressor's force structure. But basically, they fought with American weapons. The helmets, and this is amazing to me, that someone was tasked literally to put these sort of low ridges or crests on American military helmets. I read somewhere that the first bunch of exercises were done with captured German helmets on the Aggressor guys, but they eventually put a little sort of a crest or a ridge on an American helmet and made that the Aggressor helmet.
There's probably a contractor who was like required to make all the little ridge pieces.
Right. Yeah, I assume. But I just am amazed that the army decided that was the important part of this test, was to build dumb helmets. And then they use maneuver war tactics that are a hybrid of U.S. Army tactics and Wehrmacht tactics. And then they start using insurgency tactics. And that's a whole different bunch of things that, you know, as America is training for the wars it's actually fighting, not the war it wants to fight, you get more and more of that showing up with the Aggressor stay-behinds and holdout units somewhere around Fort Bragg, where they're still perhaps lurking today, Robin, I guess. I don't know.
Right.
If we weren't able to winkle them out in 30 years.
Now, unfortunately, somebody in the military in 1978 got the idea that Aggressor was tired or corny and decided to do a grim, dark reboot and replaced it in with Krasnovia, which also was more explicitly Soviet.
Yes, they used exclusively and explicitly Soviet military weapons and tactics. By then, we had enough Warsaw Pact equipment that we could kit out units with it. There were whole units that were based at Fort Irwin, California, that trained with those weapons and in Soviet tactics. And this is, you know, like battalion and stronger strength units that are training to be Soviet units to fight against the American forces that are coming into Fort Irwin to train. Krasnovia has a cool flag. It is the Democratic People's Republic of Krasnovia. It is communist, or it was, I guess. Maybe it, you know, stopped being communist after the 90s. But if it has the insane amount of backstory and lore that Aggressor does, no one has put it on the web. Maybe there's somewhere a field manual of Krasnovia, but I feel like if there was, someone would know about it and it would be on the web, because most
field
manuals
are on the web. 78 is late enough that military folks would have D&D already, so they're just using all of that creative muscle in their D&D campaigns, not on Krasnovia.
But once you've, you know, established Krasnovia and you've started building units that are trained in Soviet tactics, they have a crazy home field advantage, because they're always defending the same space, even though they're theoretically the aggressors. Your job is to winkle them out of the area of Fort Irwin that they're in. So there are now, you know, you can get Krasnovia campaign medals, Krasnovia t-shirts, the whole nine yards. In 2002, Krasnovia got a tactical upgrade. They stopped using explicitly Soviet tactics in 97. In 2002, they got a tactical upgrade. Krasnovia, at least their military, was split between North Krasnovia and South Krasnovia, because someone noticed that the European theater Russian forces were stronger and different and more flexible than Asian theater Russian forces. So North Krasnovia is now encouraged to be flexible, use ad hoc technology and tactics. They use chemical weapons at the drop of a hat, because they're evil. And they have theater ballistic missiles that will land on you if you take too long to get to an objective. And so that is how we've been fighting Krasnovia, which we do on and off even today. Although, of course, you know, with the end of the Cold War, Robin, the threat splinter, North Brownland, trying to invade South Brownland. This was in 2013. We had to put them down. We have two pretender rands.
There's no effort being put into brown land.
No, that's just a lazy, that's a Superman 4 level situation. We have two pretend Irans. One is a mostly electronic warfare exercise in White Sands Missile Range, where we test Army military communications equipment. That's Elysia, and they are aided, Robin, however, by the Wolf Pack, a group of elite hackers, possibly from Krasnovia.
Right.
And Elysia invades Attica, which is the White Sands Missile Range. And then the other pretender ran, Ariana, no relation to beloved pop star Ariana Grande, always invades Atropia, the most Q8-like part of Fort Polk, Louisiana. And I have seen, you know, Atropia Garrison Forces shirts. So it's a big deal. Atropia is also been threatened by Danovia, which is pretend Russia. So very exciting there.
Well, they must be, a tactically important area.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's a strategic dagger pointed at the heart of Cortina, which is also in Fort Polk. And Robin, you won't believe it, but the People's Democratic Republic of Arcadia sponsors an insurgency, the Cortina Liberation Front, in innocent Cortina. And
elves? We're fighting elves now?
We're fighting elves. Cortina and Arcadia, I believe, are on an island that was discovered by, and someone has begun putting backstory back in, because we fight these wars often enough, that 1342, Eric the Great landed on the island that has Arcadia and Cortina in it. Or this may be a different island. That may be the Pineland Island, which is menaced by Atlantica, and that's Special Forces School. But there's two islands, and one of them's Arcadia and one of them's Atlantica, and I can't remember which is which. But they're out in the Atlantic somewhere, and the one with Atlantica on it has a somewhat longer backstory. It's still not the madness that is Aggressor, but it's at least, you know, enough that you understand that the local indigenous tribes were originally Venezuelan Indians, for example. That's a fact that you need in your pretend
war. I'm glad they finally got another gamer to punch this up.
Right, yes. And finally, the U.S. Marine Corps fights Montana, which is always intervening in Centralia. The Marines not really working at the names, I feel like. That's North Brownland energy, and I don't like it. And in case you are worried that Russia is sponsoring all of these enemy forces, they have their own fish to fry. They fight Veshnoria and its NATO Lickspittle allies, Vesbaria and Lubinia, and they fight them in Belarus, or they used to when they were doing training exercises in Belarus instead of having a real war to get everyone exercised about. But these were exercises in Belarus that happened every 5 years, and so Veshnoria would raise its head and have to be cleaned out by a Russian invasion.
Well, I think it turns out that Veshnoria has drones.
Yeah, I think Veshnoria has a lot of drones now. And so the Russians are tangled up. But that does not mean, Robin, that the Krasnovian threat has gone away, because it is still lurking in the mountains of Fort Irwin, as I understand it.
Right. So gaming-wise, in addition to being a very familiar gaming document, you could just take the backstory of Aggressor and make it an alternate reality, right? Go as far as the backstory goes to the mid-50s and, you know, set your familiar yet unfamiliar post-war world. And from that, you could justify all sorts of 50s sci-fi technological advances. And I think you could have a lot of fun with an Aggressor campaign. And
it does sound like a great backstory for like a kaiju fighting game. If you're in the 50s and 60s and the kaiju are all out and scientists from Aggressor are always trying to mess with things.
Yeah, they probably released the kaiju. I wouldn't put it past them.
I would not.
Because America has grown weak and vulnerable and demobilized. So, of course, you'd release the kaiju.
That's when you do it.
Well, before the kaiju comes stomping our way, it's time for us to run screaming out of this hut and see what other hut we might duck safely into. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral in the Delta Green campaign, God's Teeth.
that span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Ensure that this podcast always has a safe home base by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Jeff Cars,
Jean-Francois Parody,
Josh Borlase,
Mark Waterhouse,
and Thinking Sideways.
The whir of the projector, the smell of the popcorn, and the feel of whatever that is under our feet, the sticky stuff, as we make our way to the center seats in the center aisle of the cinema hut, tell us that we are settling in once more for our fantasy film Essentials series, and we have gotten, at great effort and with great cost, into the 1950s, and so we are beginning I think that the immediate concerns of the wartime era have now passed. Fantasy seems more unhinged. It is reaching back a little bit to old fantasy stories, but it is also beginning to sort of, I think, really start to find its sea legs as a genre now. And we're still not yet in familiar dragons and sorcerers. So America's greatest fantasist, Dr. Theodore Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss, brings us The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, 1953, directed by Roy Rowland. And the movie is written by Dr. Seuss. The set design, production design, also very Dr. Seuss-y. And it has the Dr. Seuss protagonist Bartholomew, in which he is being hounded by his piano teacher. And his piano teacher is, of course, actually a fantastic supervillain who has a giant piano that requires 500 children to play it, hence the 5,000 fingers of Dr. T. And it is a trip. It is an amazing thing to watch and then to think, nope, this is made in 1953 straightforwardly, and it is unhinged, I think is the best thing you... Maybe not the best thing.
Yes, this has become a cult film over time, but was a flop when it was released, because as later generations of filmmakers refused to learn, actually putting Dr. Seuss stuff in live action is terrifying. This is especially scary, this one, because it's about a kid and his mom, and turns out a potential candidate for dad are all trapped in this nightmare realm. Even the trailer promises a tickling torture chamber, but it's an amazing explosion of weirdness, as you suggest. It's the closest thing to Pee Wee Herman before there was Pee Wee Herman, but much more disturbing. And Hans Conrad plays Dr. T, Dr. Terwilliger, and is very funny and also quite scary.
Yeah, it's a magical movie. And if you have a Dr. Seuss lover in your own heart or in your household, it is certainly worth watching. It is not as hideous as many live-action Dr. Seuss movies would be later. It is just startling and scary and messed up.
And a musical, we forgot to say. It's a musical.
And a musical. That's right, yeah. How could I forget the songs, Robin? Dr. Seuss, of course, also wrote the lyrics to the songs. Speaking of plays that became movies, in 1953, the J.M. Barrie play Peter Pan, which had been a movie, I think, twice before then, gets the Disney treatment, and that is the Peter Pan that is stuck in everyone's head ever since, despite another two or three Peter Pan movies after that. And I'm not sure, but I think this is the only time we're going to go to the Barry play, so everyone knows it. Wendy Darling is the sort of surrogate mom for these kids. There are real parents, but they're off doing business all the time. And Peter Pan shows up and brings them to Neverland because he wants Wendy to be his surrogate mom in weird British psycho history. And then also he wants playmates, but he is menaced, of course, perhaps effectually, by Captain Hook. And Captain Hook is voiced in this charming example of sort of classic Disney animation by Hans Conried, Dr. Terwilliger. So someone was getting a little typecast, I guess.
Right. And just like the play, he also voices George Darling, the father. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is basically has become in everyone's minds the classic renderings of all of these characters. And Bill Thompson as Mr. Smee is another somewhat soft-hearted henchman, another classic vocal performance. It's just beautifully rendered, just one of those things like Pinocchio before it, where kind of every frame is right. And if you're of our generation, it's imprinted in you more than you might think. And I don't know if the kids today put this on like they do Lilo and Stitch or Frozen, but it's definitely a fantasy essential for sure. Now we're going to go also in 1953 to one of the tent poles of international cinema, Ujetsu, directed by Kenji Mishiguchi. This is based on the 1776 book Ujetsu Monogatari. It also has a B-plot that kind of sort of incorporates a Maupassant story, and that's called How We Got the Legion of Honor. And the theme in this sort of, they're interwoven and the characters know each other. It's an anthology film, but it's about two men who in different ways leave their families behind and the woe that that creates. And the main story is of a potter who goes off to sell his wares. He leaves his wife and child behind, and he heads off and meets a noble woman and is seduced by her into forgetting his family. And it turns out, he discovers from a Buddhist monk whose job it is to get rid of such things, that the lady is a ghost. She's dead. And that's a problem requiring an exorcism. And it's interesting that it sort of refers to Maupassant, because the ghost who appears at first to be a living person is a thing that goes through his horror stories as well. The B story is not supernatural, so we won't talk about it here so much. It is has a ghost in it, but it's a drama. It's a beautiful, serious film by one of Japan's great filmmakers. Mizoguchi is a sort of in the subtlety versus robust drama spectrum. He's kind of in between Kurosawa and Ozu, and this is one of his great works. And Michiko Kyo, one of the great actresses of the classic Japanese period, appears as Lady Wakasa, the ghost. So you can dial that up. I'm pretty sure it's on the Criterion Channel. It's in the Janet's collection, or grab the Criterion disc. It is a world classic that everybody should check out. And speaking of international world classics, Ken, you're going to talk about probably the archetypal foreign film that people make fun of when they're making foreign films, except it's a great film.
Yeah. This is the Ingmar Bergman film to beat all Ingmar Bergman films. And as you say, the thing that people think all foreign films are, and we should be so lucky, The Seventh Seal, 1957. And this is a philosophical fantasy in which a knight is returned from the Crusades. He's come back to Sweden. Sweden is ravaged by the Black Death. Everything is terrible. And he chooses to play chess with death in an attempt to basically redeem himself. And it's a young Max von Sydow as the knight. Death is played by Bengt Ekeroth. And that is the action, is basically this intellectual and philosophical duel, which is the least duely duel in the history of fantasy, I would assume.
Right. It's literally chess.
It's literally chess.
Yes. He's trying to win not his life necessarily, but the life of a young mother and father and their child. Mm-hmm. He is tormented by what has happened in the Crusades. He went there full of faith. He's lost his faith. That's where the very Bergman-y part comes in. And Bengt Ekeroth as death looks pretty much exactly like death in Fritz Lang's Destiny, which we mentioned in our first go-round of these films. So that shows that imagery coming forward in time. Finally, the last thing we're going to describe in full is back to more swords and magic and derring do. This is the seventh voyage of Sinbad, directed in 1958 by Nathan Uran, who is a journeyman director who has a few sort of classic films under his belt. But you want the direction here to be pretty foursquare because the main attraction is Harryhausen's animated figures using his Dynamation process, which of course is his using stop motion figures to register more vividly in Technicolor. I don't know what his exact technical changes were for this, but this is the one with the Cyclops, the giant lizard, the rock, as in the giant bird, not as in a boulder. You don't need to animate a boulder. And there's a duel with a skeleton. Kerwin Matthews appears as Sinbad. He's a good, stout, convincing, not that interesting hero. Catherine Grant, similarly, the Princess Parisa, she gets some good shtick to do because she gets shrunk down, so that's fun. And Torrin Thatcher is Sakura, the evil sorcerer. So that's, and this will spawn a ton of imitators in the late 50s and even more so in the 60s, which we will not mention because none of them are as good as the key Harryhausen titles.
Yeah, and this is also, I think, probably one of the key documents for what are called Sword and Sandal or Sword and Peplum movies, and most of them star Steve Reeves, it seems, but they all have Hercules in them, and it's very much the Italian directors are like, we don't have Sinbad. What do we have? Hercules, let's go. And they make 8 million Hercules movies. And I don't know that Hercules is going to show up anywhere except in our allusion to him as a son of Sinbad, confounding both mythology and chronology.
Not even the Mario Bava one is quite good enough to be an essential, although it is watchable and I recommend watching it. Finally, before we wrap up the 50s, a shout out, but not a full entry into the Hall of Fantasy Essentials to Black Orpheus, the 1959 film by Marcel Camus, which retells the myth of Orpheus in Brazil. And the reason it's another must-see world classic, a beautiful film. Its music is stunning. The performances are very moving. But it renders the myth in a completely naturalistic form. So there's nothing supernatural going on or, you know, nothing definitively supernatural. Therefore, I don't think it's really quite a fantasy film, but worth a mention just so that you don't say, why didn't we mention it?
And it does have an atmosphere of sort of a dreamlike magic, but the dreamlike magic is the dreamlike magic of a love story, not the dreamlike magic of an actual dreamlike magic thing happening. So, yeah, everything you say is correct. It's a magical movie in the sense of it transports you. It's a tremendous watch, and the music is terrific. This is, you know, when Afro-Brazilian music is really coming out into world music. So it's very propulsive and exciting and thrilling to watch, or even just to pop the soundtrack on. But you should watch it because it is a great movie, even though, as you say, it is not a fantasy film, much less a fantasy essential. And once we have said something's not a fantasy essential, then I guess that means that we have to leave our popcorn bucket behind and head out of the theater and let them clean it for next week's installment while we move through the lobby into another hut.
The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is currently released as a PDF with physical pre-orders available.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
Now it's time to venture into that vaguest of huts, the hut where we're really not sure what's going on, where there's sort of somebody writing a crockpot history over in the corner over there, and there's some weird unconventional maps on the wall here, and Oh, but if we look out the window, we see the alien big cat. He's screaming out in the moor. That tells us that we're once more in the Elliptony hut, the hut of the paranormal, the hut of ghost sightings and hoaxes. And this time, as both the gray alien and the Nordic alien can attest, having read our notes, this is a story of a ghost hoax gone terribly wrong. It's the Hammersmith ghost murder case. So the neighborhood that Dragon Meat was in until last year, it's moving to a different neighborhood without ghost murders. I don't know whether it's intentional or just a coincidence, but Ken, tell us about this 1803 case in which shenanigans result in catastrophe.
Yeah. Okay. Hammersmith at this point is not a neighborhood. It is a village outside London. And starting in November of 1803, there have been several ghost sightings in and around the churchyard of St. Paul's Chapel of Ease. And this is a church in Hammersmith. People said that it was the ghost of a suicide who had been buried in the churchyard against doctrine and therefore was allowed to sort of wander around as a ghost because he wasn't properly buried at the crossroads like he should have been. He was a tall figure clad in white, sometimes described as having glass eyes, great glass eyes. Sometimes they say he has horns, but he's mostly your standard ghost, big, white, looming, scary figure. And there have been one sighting that seems to have been pretty well accepted, including in court, spoiler. Local brewer Thomas Groom was grabbed by the throat from behind and saw the ghost flitting away through the churchyard. Rumored sightings included two women, one pregnant and one elderly, who both took to their beds in shock and died after seeing the ghost. And this is very much, I heard it from Witta Jenkins, who heard it from Saul the boot seller type story. A wagoner was supposed to have nearly lost control of his 8-horse coach, frightened by the ghost. Everyone in the wagon, you know, says, "What are you doing? You nearly ran us into a tree." And sure enough, the wagoner said, "Oh, I just saw the ghost. I wasn't drunk at all. You're confused." So Hammersmith is agog and on edge. And on December 29th, the night watchman, the local night watchman, a fellow named William Girdler, pursued the ghost, saw it, lost it when it took off its white shroud and sped off. So it was a ghost that could shed its shroud, which is even more terrifying, I assume. But local anti-ghost vigilantes began to patrol. So January 3rd, 1804, Girdler meets just such a vigilante, a 29-year-old excise officer named Francis Smith, and Smith says, "I'm going to go hunt the ghost." And Girdler says, "You should. I've got to finish up my patrol, but once I get off shift, I will join you." And Girdler goes off, and he calls the 11 o'clock hour, and shortly thereafter, he hears a gunshot, and he runs to the site, and he sees that Francis Smith has shot the ghost with his fowling piece, his shotgun. But, Robin, the person shot is not a ghost. It is a plasterer named Thomas Millwood, who was visiting his sister and parents, and he was wearing his newly washed white trousers, waistcoat, and apron, everything white. And he dies in the street with his sister there, and Smith immediately surrenders to the constable. He is arraigned for murder and tried on January 11th. The wheels of justice turned faster in 1804, and he's tried mostly on the basis of his full and spontaneous confession. And you can read the transcript in the Newgate calendar, but the best part of the trial seems to be that when the victim's mother-in-law insists on testifying, this is Millwood's mother-in-law, testifies that she told Millwood he looked like the ghost in that outfit, and that he'd already frightened 3 other people accidentally, but would he listen? No, he would not, and now he's dead, because he wouldn't listen to his mother-in-law. And you can imagine the judge banging his gavel and saying, "I think yes, we've basically got the story. Thank you so much.
We don't have the term victim blaming yet, ma'am, but I think you're engaging in that.
I think you're engaging. How dare you talk that way to
me?" Right, yes. Another point that was made at the trial is that you can't plead self-defense if you're not being attacked, whether you're being attacked by a human, let alone someone you think is a ghost. And the accused shot at Millwood the moment he saw him.
Yeah.
And so he was not being attacked. But there's still a question that was left unresolved for many years later, arising out of this case, is can you claim self-defense if you're mistaken? Are you legally liable for murder if you have a dumb idea that leads you to kill somebody out of putative self-defense? This raises a number of questions that I'm not sure were addressed at the trial, like did you really think it was a ghost if you thought you could get rid of it by shooting it? Or did you think it was a guy dressed as a ghost grabbing people? That's a little unclear.
Yeah, certainly all the later treatment and the treatment at the time centered on the notion that Smith thought he was shooting a ghost. And I guess back in the day, they didn't know shooting didn't work against ghosts, or he figured he was the guy in the opening act who would shoot the ghost ineffectually, and then they would have to go get a priest to deal with it somehow. The jury is moved to sympathy and pity by his spontaneous confession, clear remorse, and maybe by the fact that Millwood was parading around in white on ghost nights. That's wild.
Even his mother-in-law said he was asking for it.
Right, yep. So the jury tries to give Smith manslaughter, but the judge says he's not on trial for manslaughter. He's only on trial for murder. Either you have to find him guilty or not guilty. And you shouldn't find him not guilty because he shot that guy dead.
Said he did it.
Yeah. So they find him guilty. The Crown commutes his death sentence almost immediately to a year at hard labor and then pardons him on July 14th. So he winds up doing about 6 months of time for shooting Millwood, which is, it is a note of mercy in early 19th century jurisprudence, certainly.
Yes, that was not a good time to be charged with murder. No. So he definitely got off easy.
Yeah. The actual ghost comes forward on January the 5th because of all the brouhaha. And he is a bootmaker named John Graham, and he's been dressing up as the ghost to frighten his apprentices in revenge, he says, for them scaring his kids with ghost stories. And although he has at the very least committed assault against Thomas Groom, no one quite knows what to charge him with. So he's granted bail, and then they just don't charge him with anything. So he basically gets off with a fine.
Yes, and few of the sources reveal that the names of those kids are scared by the ghost stories were Shaggy and Scooby.
Exactly, yes. Scooby was the name of a boy in 1804, not a name of a dog. That would happen after the war.
Yeah, Thomas Scooby.
Yes, Thomas Scooby. So you can still go to Hammersmith. You can still go and see the murder site. It is the Black Lion Pub, or it's near the Black Lion Pub. It wasn't right in the pub, but it's in Black Lion Street, which was right near there. And as you say, Robin, it created a jurisprudential humdinger that lasted until 1984.
Right. So an appeals court finally sorted this out in 1984 in a different case where a man was charged with assault for badly injuring a man. He came upon one guy dragging another guy along and attacked the guy who was dragging the other guy. But it turned out the man who had hold of this person had apprehended a thief and was not the one who needed to be thumped. And so the appeals court cited the Hammersmith case, and they clarified that in the UK, a reasonable mistaken belief is a valid defense. Not that in the original case there was an actual self-defense.
Right.
But that an unreasonably mistaken belief is not. It still seems confused to me because, again, he was just running in his Batinsky to wail on somebody. But in the UK, if you are reasonably mistaken that you should be wailing on somebody, you'll get off. So yeah. That's good to know.
Yeah. So, kids, make sure that when you go beat up your favorite British person, that you claim that you thought they were a ghost and everything will be cool.
Right. In the horror scenario version of this, either you're, I guess, do a sort of skullduggery style where there's sort of the player characters are con artists somehow trying to take advantage of this situation, or they are posing as ghosts. Or most player groups are going to want a real ghost to show up at some point. Perhaps even, ironically, the ghost of Thomas Millwood.
Yeah. I think that this makes a great esoterror op because you've got the real ghost, you've got the pretend ghost that's the sort of play with reality that they have as the esoterists. And I think you could move it forward to any city in the world now where there's a ghost that's been rumored to go around attacking people. Someone, you know, is carrying, they shoot him dead. Oh, there's a big whoop-de-doo. There's a trial of the century. There's a crazy spectacle made of, did this guy think it was a ghost or not? And it is in that sort of circus atmosphere that the esoterists can have their real ghosts show up out of the outer dark and mess with people. And then you have to put them down, probably not with a shotgun, though, I assume.
Right. And these are kind of solid ghosts. They're grabbing people and stuff.
Yeah.
So that possibly.
Well, M.R. James ghosts grab people all the time. I don't think that it's impossible the ghosts can grab people.
Right. Well, some ghosts need killing, Ken.
Exactly. And,
perhaps that's what the player characters will get up to.
Whether by shooting or some other better method.
Right. Well, on that note, it's time for us to, in the correct belief that this podcast episode is over, but in the even more correct belief that there'll be another one a mere 7 days from today, it's time for us to wave goodbye, not that you'll see that because this is an audio medium, and promise to come back next week. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Shield this podcast from Aggressor and Krasnovia by joining such backers as
Trung Boy.
John Rogers.
Merrick Shinkariel.
Jan Zaleski.
And Alan McSager.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Grab our latest design, Subtlety is for People Who Forgot Their Battering Ram.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time, and once again, we will talk about stuff.